Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone I've been on tour with kind of twice, so kind of a road dog, from the band Rat Pack, from the band, no use for a name, from the band The Foo Fighters, also has his own solo career, my buddy, my pal, Chris Shiflett, the guy who gave me a germs burn. More on that in 1 second, but first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left for Damian. There is a Facebook page, a TikTok page, a YouTube page, and an Instagram page, all for this podcast, and all those can be found at turnedoutofpunk. On those respective platforms. If you want to support this show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast, and that'll help. You can also support me by checking out the band I play in. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. We are going to be going on tour with Superchunk at the end of January. We got some records and all sorts of crap coming down the pipeline. You can find out more, though, at fuckedup.cc. All right. On to today's show. And I said off the top, my buddy, we've been on tour, Australia, New Zealand, two shows in Canada with the Foo Fighters. This is someone that, I grew up as a fan of and then got to meet. And then they ended up stabbing a cigarette into my wrist to give me the historic germs burn. Chris Shiflett is on the show. And Chris is someone who is an incredibly talented guitar player, played in all sorts of different types of bands, and had a real interesting journey that has brought him to be in the biggest band in the world at this point, biggest rock band in the world, arguably, in the Foo Fighters. Being on tour with them was one of the great experiences that I've gotten to have while singing in Fucked Up. And as I said, one day on tour, I'd been bugging Pat Smear like every day of the tour to give me a germs burn. And Pat said he only gave one out ever, and that was to Darby. And then Chris overheard and said, well, I have a germs burn. And I said, really? And then that's how I got mine. I think we talk about it in the show. If we don't, I'll explain it all. It'll come up in future episodes. But I'm pretty sure we talk about it in this interview. Chris has a new solo record, which you can find out now everywhere. It's called Lost at Sea on Bluian Records. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Bluian? Chris will also be going on tour with this new record. He'll be playing in January in Auckland, New Zealand at the Whammy Bar. And then he'll be playing in the UK and Ireland starting on March 20th and going on all the UK. So he's also going to Scotland. He's going to all sorts of places. You can find out more details about this and the new record at chrisshiflettmusic.com. And I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Chris Shiflett, my germs burn buddy, on Turned Out a Punk.
Yeah. So you've clearly learned the golden rule of podcasting, and that is make sure you're recording the small talk leading into it, because that's where the best shit happens.
Well, I also find that I get so excited about doing these things that I want to bring up all these bands to you off air, and then we roll into the episode and we've already talked about Lost Kittens or something.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
But yeah. It is a thrill to have you here, my friend, because not only are we tour buddies, but you are the only person in my life that I've ever let put a cigarette out on me.
Wait, did I give you a germs burn?
I got a germs burn from you on that tour. It was...
Oh, boy.
I bothered Pat for one every day of the tour, and then finally you overheard and said, I got a germs burn, and broke down the lineage, and it is a real germs burn, and I said, can I get one, and we filmed it.
Ah, yeah, it's a funny thing with that whole, the rules around that, because, you know, Pat doesn't actually have a germs burn, but since he gave the first one, he is the starting point, so he can do as he pleases, I believe is how that goes. They just had a party over at his house the other night for his wife's birthday, and Shane West was there, who was the actor that played Darby in the movie, and I hadn't seen him in a long time, but he's actually the guy that gave me my germs burn. So we There's a lot of germs burn nostalgia going on this week.
I think in vampire lore, that would make him our like father vampire,
Right,
because it's vampire
exactly.
rules, right?
Yeah,
And
right, exactly.
he got his from Lorna, rest in peace, who got hers from Darby, who rest in peace, who got his from Pat. And Pat said he only ever gave out one to Darby, and that was it.
Oh, okay. Well, no wonder he's so stingy with the germs burns.
Exactly. I felt
Yeah.
like, and I think a mutual friend of ours, Fat Mike, insists that he will get one from Pat. But I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Good luck, man. That's like, two titans. That's Godzilla versus King Kong. Who's going to win that one?
I think there's going to be a war of attrition. They both are partners in that punk museum together.
Right. Yeah. I haven't been, and we were in Las Vegas the other night for the iHeartRadio festival thing, and I was hoping to be able to get over there and see it, but we literally like flew in and flew out, so there was no time. But by all accounts, it's really pretty great.
It is. There's a lot of stuff there that, punk is like religion, where everyone's got their own definition about what it is.
It's
So
totally.
it's going to be a
It's
thankless
often
task.
it's that yeah. The term punk rock is a funny one, because I noticed that a long time ago. Like, people just sort of use it to mean whatever they want. Oftentimes, use it like as an out. Hey man, I'm just being punk, man. It's like the inverse of like, the way they use the term rock star. Quit acting like a rock star, which usually means like I didn't do the thing that I was supposed to do, and you're complaining about it. So I'm going to tell you're being a rock star.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think with like even looking at your band, every single member is from punk. Being the Foo Fighters, your band, obviously your solo stuff too, but like I think every single member of the band is from a different punk scene, which had very different definitions and rules of what this thing was.
I mean, it really, like, if you I think I've thought about that a lot, because that's sort of the world of punk rock that I got to know as a teenager in the back half of the 80s, was at that time there was that thing of like there was sort of a moral superiority attached to indie music, in all its many forms. Which is so different than, like, if you look at like the British wave of punk rock in the mid to late 70s, that were all, had like major label record deals and didn't it, like that whole thing came later of like, of not being part of like corporate rock and all that shit that became so kind of fused into a lot of like what people sort of consider punk rock to be. I think it's a real, like, I think, I mean, having put music out on labels of every size over the years, I can tell you they basically all function the same. I would say it's like once I actually started making records and putting out records and working in as a musician, like, that whole side of it just became clear to me that it just had there was no truth to it whatsoever. You know what I mean?
But I think it's fascinating because like you do talk about fiercely independent people, Fat Mike and Fat Records and Ian MacKaye and Fugazi, and kind of like the world that Dave would have kind of been coming out of early on, Revolution Summer. They're both radically independent versions of punk rock that have nothing in common with each other other than the fact that they're both punk.
I mean, different eras, different, just musically different, I mean, I will say, having worked closely with Fatty, back in the day, I mean, he really did run his label like it. That was maybe the out of any situation I've ever been in, like he really took care of the bands and was very honest. Never said he was going to do X, Y, and Z, and then didn't do it. And, I mean, he would, like, I joined No Use for a Name. I wasn't like on any of those records for a while. It took a while before we ever made a record, and he didn't really make that much money on tour. So I would come home from tour with a little bit of money in my pocket, but I'd squander it in a month or two. And he would always give me a job that he didn't have to give me, like just he would just kind of make work around the office for me, just to put a little money in my pocket so I could get to sustain myself to the next tour,
I think it's also interesting when you look at who he gave jobs to too. There's like a lot of people, be it like Chris Dodge, yourself, there's various other people that ran labels that also had a day job working at Fat.
Yeah. Now, Chris Dodge gave me my nickname, man. That's where I got the name Jackson from. No, Chris Dodge didn't give me the nickname. Mike did, but it was because of Chris Dodge that I had to get the nickname. Because there were Mike didn't want to have two people named Chris in the office. Yeah. So yeah, He just came in one day and goes, you're going to be Jackson from now on. I was like, what? It's like, all right.
Yeah, he's still got his Mike side too.
Yeah.
As great as he is to work with, he's sometimes also Mike to work with too. So, we're going to get there. But I got to start this off though, with I'll start off, which is, Chris, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah, I'm old. I remember when the Sex Pistols happened and just not because we were into them or anything, but because it just made a lot of headlines. You just heard of this scary thing called punk rock. And my brother Mike, who's my oldest brother, went just kind of out of curiosity because we were listening to Black Sabbath and Aerosmith and stuff like that, Kiss. And he went and bought the Sex Pistols record and the first Clash record and brought them home. And I remember the consensus in my house was, that shit sucks. I think about that all the time. Like, God, what if we had sort of heard that different? Like, I would have been on a very different musical path early. But that was not what, we were like little suburban kids in the 70s. So that was not what we were into. And it wasn't until later, probably halfway through junior high, really kind of through skateboarding, that I started to hear bands like Social Distortion and TSOL and JFA. I remember my friend Luke had a JFA record. We'd listen to it and skate his half pipe, stuff like that. I've said this many times, but where I grew up, the local sort of high school aged bands were all either punk rock or thrash metal. This is like the mid to late 80s. So when you went to a party on the weekend, or if you went to see a show or something, that's pretty much what it exclusively would have been, like speed metal, thrash metal, or punk rock. And punk rock at that point was not that far removed from speed metal, thrash metal. There was a lot of kind of overlap in those sounds. So that just kind of being around, GBH, DRI, stuff like that. RKL, of course. Yeah, my wife's making breakfast right now. Somebody's at the door, honey. For the, I think the lady's here to groom our dog, who is, if you could see, very, very dirty, needs a grooming.
Been a long process.
Yeah. Oh, no, RKL was a big one in Santa Barbara, and they were the hometown band.
Probably one of the most interesting bands in the history of American underground music, RKL.
Yeah, I mean, they're super duper influential on everything, on all the stuff that came after it. I mean, Fat Mike will tell you, he basically took RKL's sort of aggro, high speed, crazy shit and fused it with Bad Religion style melodic songs. That's kind of where you get that sound.
When he's come on the show, he's talked about it. It's like the only band in history that he describes having phrases it differently, but a sex worker and a pimp in the band at the same time. And it also is
of course he phrased it that way.
Yeah, well, he phrased it differently. That was my kind of rounding the edges off a little bit. But there's a real darkness to that band too. I think John Worster from Superchunk, when he was on the show, talked about them being in Europe playing with RKL later on, of course, and them having a roadie at the start of tour. And then by the end of tour, the roadie not being on tour because the roadie had passed away and they'd sent his body home.
That was Will Moeller. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that's it, if you sort of take a slightly more wide angle view of that, I mean, that is, and I think it was true of probably a lot of California beach town culture at that time. And I think the same could be probably said of Santa Cruz or, anywhere, but there was a real heavy drug scene that kind of swept through Santa Barbara in particular and heroin and cocaine and all that stuff. And it really took out a lot of people. So, yeah.
It seems like that's also systemic with punk too. Like everywhere you
Sure.
go to this day, like it's,
Yeah.
I sadly lost friends recently because of the same sort of thing, but it's a scene that draws people that seem to have trauma, which of course it welcomes addiction in a lot of cases. And
Sure. Yeah, it's an interesting thing because there were a lot of people that died young from all that shit, and then now we're at the age where there's a lot of people that are just kind of wearing out, you know? I mean, but Jason Sears and Bomber and just a whole, I mean, there's a never-ending ongoing, we just lost a couple of friends recently to that shit, some old Santa Barbara friends that it just actually there's a song on my new record called Dead and Gone that I wrote exactly about that, that's kind of specifically about a couple of old friends that I grew up with that died a couple of years ago, when I was writing the songs that are on my new record. But yeah, it's a real tragedy. It's kind of like there's kind of a lost generation in a way. All these cats like Matt Rat, from Rat Pack. I know you know who Rat Pack was. I always said like Matt, he had that kind of like he had a charisma to him that and like I don't know and a and sort of street smarts and a way of kind of being that if that had been channeled in a maybe in a more positive way, like he could have, I don't know, been a CEO or something. You know what I mean? But
Yeah.
like. But yeah, like back to what you said a second ago, it's like this thing draws in people that are kind of fucked up, Like I don't think anybody winds up being a musician and that isn't. It's kind of the weird thing of like being a musician because like it's you're kind of a fucked up in some way, and that's why you do it. And then if you won't manage to have any success, people expect you to be like a decent member of your community and. And then that's why musicians are always putting their foot in their mouth and saying dumb shit, getting in trouble,
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you're also, because you're also like weirdly profiting off your mental health or your
Your
trauma
lack of
or
mental health, yeah.
your lack of mental health.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there's sort of this, yeah, they want you till they don't. And until like all of a sudden the mental health stuff becomes too heavy. And it's like, okay, we
Yeah.
gotta cut this. And then it becomes almost like people laugh at it. It becomes at
Yeah,
a certain point. And
totally,
it's,
totally.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But to transition to back to music awkwardly, there's with Rat Pack, you brought up like talk about another band that's super fascinating. Dave from NOFX was in that band too, yourself and like another band that's full of cool people.
Yeah, no, that was an interesting time. Like when I remember the first time I saw Rat Pack was actually the first. Like kind of real show I ever played. I briefly in like 10th grade was in a band called Legion of Doom, and we got on a show at the Golden Eagle Pool Hall in Santa Barbara, which was like it sounds, just a pool hall. That's nowadays it's an Urban Outfitters, which is very,
As they all are.
yeah, very fitting. But yeah, at the time it was this rundown old pool hall, the sort of towards the lower end of State Street, and they started having punk rock shows there for a minute. And so the show was my band opened and then Rat Pack played and then NOFX and then Excel headlined. But
Oh, what a show.
in Rat Pack at that time, Vince, who had recently left RKL, was playing bass. And now I think Dave Casillas was in yeah no Dave Casillas was in Rat Pack at that time.
Yeah,
Yeah,
because I know he plays on one of the Rat Pack records. I think the first 7-inch, right?
because he okay, so he was playing. I'm trying to get remember this right because that was maybe from around that time, maybe right after that he joined NOFX because I think he's on one of those early NOFX records too. But
Liberal Animation.
yes, but at the time he was still in Rat Pack, and it's funny because I still have this big ding in my guitar because I lent him my guitar at that show. And he smashed it into one of the cymbals. And I remember I put a big, put a big chop in the bottom side of it. And every time I see it, I go, Dave Casillas, Golden Eagle Pool Hall. Yeah, that was, but then from that show, So Vince was in Rat Pack and Dave, and then yeah, then Dave joined NoFX, and then Vince left, and then I joined Rat Pack on bass. And then
Oh,
Alpo
awesome.
started playing guitar, I guess around that same time. So yeah, things were just shifting around.
Did Legion of Doom ever record?
We made a really crappy demo on a four track that I don't know if any of that, I don't know if any of us have any of that recording left at this point. Yeah. But we never made like a record or anything, no.
Did you ever get a chance to record with Doug Moody?
Not with him directly. No, the Rat Pack 7-inch that I played on, we recorded at a house in Goleta, and man, I wish I knew who it was that engineered it. I don't remember. It was just in some dude's living room, kind of slapped together. And man, I wish those tapes still existed. You can find that on YouTube. I've gone and listened to it. It sounds like it
Well, I've
was
listened.
recorded. It's very tinny. It's very thin.
That's that Mystic Records production. That's that
Yeah.
Oxnard sound.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
That is like I don't know, like I love it. Like I know so many people, especially from that time, that are like, "Oh, I hate all those records. They all sound like trash." But I'm like, "No, that's like I don't know, there's like a sonic quality to it that like ties it to a scene, and that's kind of like Motown in Detroit, you know? This is
Right.
like Oxnard Motown."
That's a funny way of looking at it, but I know what you mean. Yeah. It's like Motown, but if you take all the low end and the feel out of it
Yes.
and speed it up, add a bunch of cocaine, get that
What's
high-end
left?
treble. Yeah.
Yeah. What about, did you ever record with Doug Moody? Did you ever that?
No, I never even met Doug Moody. Like I don't remember the details of any of that. I just remember like we went and we recorded, and it was like in the middle of the week too. It was pretty much being in Rat Pack was what led to me dropping out of high school. Because there were, I remember I missed that I feel like we did that maybe during the week and I just skipped school. But there was a time that after we did that where we filmed some, and I wish this still existed. We filmed a video at this club downtown that I don't even know. I don't remember ever seeing the video. So I don't think it ever got finished. But that was like also in the middle of the day on like a Wednesday. And the drummer for Rat Pack was this guy, Sean Murphy. And he called the school and, pretended to be my dad to excuse me, but you know, he was 19 or something, so they didn't believe him. And he was like, "Yeah, what's up, bro? Chris can't come to school today." You know, he's just like, did not sound like anybody's dad, and they didn't believe it. And I don't think I got expelled from that one, but I got sent to, what do they call it? Like suspended or whatever. Like, I remember I had to go to this other school for a week because of that. And it just, you know, it just kind of like there was no getting back on track at that point. And then I just dropped out.
It's wild how, like you mentioned, it's almost like the high school music of Southern California. Like punk took in Southern California in a way it didn't take anywhere else really in like North America, certainly, where there's just so many cool, interesting people involved in these bands that are playing together. It's fascinating how many of you guys were kind of like interacting, and just at these high schools where, you know, like Jack Black told me about that school that he went to, where Ed Gregor from No Use for a Name, who you replace, went to that high school, and there's that band Mustard from there, and
Oh,
Maya
really?
Rudolph went there. Yeah, like it's like, and
Oh no,
Jawbreaker all went there too.
my kids go there. I had no idea that Ed went there. I gotta check. I'm gonna check with Ed.
I
I
think
didn't
Ed
know.
went. I don't. I know. I know. Maybe
Really?
he was in Hedgehog, and members of Hedgehog were in that band Mustard, and all the guys from Mustard went there. Because I found a
Oh.
photo online of Mustard playing and Maya Rudolph's in the crowd watching them jam.
I gotta tell you, just as a little aside, my youngest son, who's now 15, over the last year or so, has gotten totally obsessed with Jawbreaker, which makes me very happy. And honestly, I had nothing to do with it. He just found them and just has gone down the Jawbreaker rabbit hole. But my kids were pretty stoked when I was like, you know, those guys went to your school, right? And I think, yeah, in the like, there's like the assembly room at school. They have outside of it, there's all these pictures of like, you know, baseball teams of years past, and Adam's in one of those pictures.
Yeah,
Yeah.
he's a great baseball player. He's
Yeah.
like an unbelievable player.
Yeah, it's
So,
cool.
not quite Scott Rudinsky scared straight level though.
Right, yeah. You know, you're talking about like that that late 80s punk rock world. Like, to be perfectly honest, like I didn't like, I was around all that stuff and kind of to a certain extent part of it, you know, with being in Rat Pack and everything. But I was even like, I've sort of viewed like punk rock as like a thing of the past at that point, even though there was all that stuff happening. There was like punk rock stuff going on. But to me, like, you know, my slightly older friends that had been around for that earlier 80s wave, had all moved on to other stuff. You know, there were other things that had happened musically that, and there was sort of a sense of like, you missed it, you know? This cool thing had happened with shows at the Olympic and all this, that whole world of like, you know, the adolescence and Agent Orange, all that stuff. And it just seemed like that was something in the rearview mirror that I had missed, you know, because I did. I wasn't a part of that. You know, I was, while all that stuff was going on, I was listening to Iron Maiden and stuff, you know, shit like that. And it was, you know, that was before the sort of explosion of that 90s punk rock stuff. So it was this little in between thing where it just felt like, I don't know, like that was, it was around, but it didn't seem like this, like a scene, you know, like we're part of this scene or what, you know, I don't know. It never had that feel to me. I sort of self-identified as a glam rocker through most of those years anyway, you know, I had like big bleached hair and wearing makeup and tight jeans, you know what I mean? So I was just like, you know, there was always the one little heavy metal kid that was played guitar in all those bands, you know, that was me.
Well, that, and I want to talk to you about that later on, but too, the guitar player thing, but because it does die in Southern California. Like, you hear about the violence just gets to such a point at these shows, like a lot of punks, like, you know, Mike and people leave. A lot of shows just get shut down by cops, and it seems like, you know, Bad Religion went into the unknown for a little bit, and it feels like everyone kind of like left, and it just became kind of too heavy. Crossover happens. It feels like it's another big thing. And it just, yeah, like you're right. Like it does. I really get the sense that there is this sort of desert period for it too, where, you know, we have people like Chris Dodge and stuff on Slapham Records that he's putting out, but it's like goes super, super underground again.
Well, it's interesting. Like in hindsight, you can kind of see like when Bad Religion put out Suffer, that was like a new beginning starting to happen. And then things, you know, then NOFX was evolving. And then a couple of years later, the Pennywise pops up and there's Lagwagon and Good Riddance and, you know, No Use for All these bands are kind of come out of that. But I don't remember it feeling like, you know, it was like stuff that we were into. Like when Suffer came out, that was one of those records that was like, everybody had it, and it was just like on at every party, and then No Control, and you know, and on and on. But it was a while before it felt like that was like a scene developing to me anyway. You know what I mean? Even like I think I was already in LA by the time it really began to kind of feel like that, you know.
It does feel like NOFX is one of the only bands that kept it going from that sort of wave of stuff. But then Scared Straight put out a record in like what, 90? I think they put out their final record, or maybe at least that's when Doug Moody put out their tapes as their final record at some point. But
Do you know whatever happened to Doug Moody? Like, is he still alive somewhere? Who control? Who has all those? Who has that catalog?
I believe he's still alive. One of my most prized records in my collection is a couple, well, this would have been 10 years ago now. They did a reissue of Rich Kids and LSD, and you could get copies autographed by Doug Moody. And they had a
Oh,
little
wow.
like sparkly sticker, star sticker on it too. And that's one of my
Oh.
prized records in my collection because I believe he still got all that stuff. It's amazing
Yeah.
too to think about that board. That board is apparently the one they used on like one of the Zeppelin records, according to legend.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Everyone
Then
points out that does not sound the
how did
same.
they make all those records sound so tinny?
Exactly. I think it takes it. That's the touch. That's that Midas touch. It's like that Ryan Green drum sound that just like people just want it.
Oh, yeah.
It's so when you kind of mentioned getting into the glam sort of sound of stuff. Is that when you kind of like form like Lost Kittens?
Lost Kittens, and it's like all high school bands went through about like 1,000 different lineups, you know? But the first lineup started for my ninth grade talent show, and it was my buddy Grant put it together. And that was one version of it. and we did a couple of Kiss covers, and then it kind of went dormant. We weren't really a band. We just did it for the talent show. And then in 10th grade, we started Legion of Doom, which was pretty short-lived. That went on for probably just a couple of months. And then we started a new version of Lost Kittens with my friend Luke and some of our friends. And then it just, like, you know, we were just always changing members for a while until we eventually, a bit later in high school, it was me, my friend Luke, was the lead singer, other guitar player, Marco, who you might know, ultimately wound up in Sugar Cult, was playing bass, and Steve Sherlock, that plays drums for Nerf Herder, was our drummer. Yeah.
It's interesting too, because, and also, I think, isn't Marco also in Bad Astronaut too?
Yeah.
With Joey from
Lagwagon Okay, so we're sort of sidestepping the Joey Cape here. Like, you got to understand, I met Joey Cape when I was like 11 or something. And Joey was like an additional big brother to me, you know? And he was a couple of years older than me. And, you know, you have those friends, and I had a few of them. But Joey was really important to my musical education. You know, you have those friends that just seem to, like, always know what the best records are and the newest bands, and just, he was, I don't know, he was on a different frequency than the rest of us. And a lot of people in our scene, I think, were pretty heavily influenced by his, you know, musical exploration. He was always bringing new music and like lots of different kinds of, you know, like, whether it be like metal stuff. He was the guy that you turned us on to Yngwie Malmsteen. Steeler, you know, stuff like that. He was the first guy I ever knew that had a Metallica record. He would have all those, like, those old compilation records that from the early 80s of all the heavy metal stuff. But also, he was a huge gateway into punk rock, you know?
Yeah.
One of the most, like, probably musically important things ever that ever happened to me was a little bit later in high school. I remember Joey bought every single Ramones record up to whatever was the current one at that time. And would buy them like two or three records at a time. And we would take them and go to his house and record them on a cassette tape. And in doing that, I, you know, of course I already knew who the Ramones were, but like, that's how I got to know their entire, like, every inch of their catalog, you know, from that. Just stuff like that.
And they never get bad, the Ramones. They're like one of those bands that it's just an evolving sound. Like, they found this sound and they just kind of like are taking it new places every time.
Yeah. That would have been around the time that Animal Boy came out. So they were kind of on an upswing, you know?
I like that record a lot.
Yeah, it's a great record. Great record.
It's interesting, like, studying them, too, and the effects that, I think it was, like, people have brought it up on this thing, like, New York hardcore and sort of the arrival of thrash metal had on the band, where Johnny felt he had to compete. And so it became, like, a war of speed, but that really bummed Joey out. And that was something that really, CJ, fellow member of Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, told me that it would make Joey, like, it would bum him out. It would be like really, it would be a huge aggravation for him that they would always play so fast. You couldn't fit the words in and all this kind of stuff. But it's metal. It's hardcore that's making Johnny do it.
Well, you know, like at that time, like songs like Warthog and stuff, you know, you can hear that influence where it's like clearly they're vibing off of sort of current, faster, harder, you know, noisier music.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So going back to Sweet Dreams, it feels like, actually, going back, sorry, to Joey Cape, it feels like that's another person that's kind of like, he talked about getting kidnapped by the members of RKL and kind of brought and made punk, kind of brought into the punk world overnight type thing.
Well, before I even knew Joey, when he was really young, he played drums.
In the pre-RKL thing, right?
Yes. And it was pre-RKL, but also pre-Rat Pack, because I think Matt Rat was in that band. I remember he had a recording of like one of their rehearsals that was really funny, where he's like giving Matt Rat shit, and you can hear Matt getting kind of grumpy about it.
So I find it fascinating, because at some point, Josh Brolin becomes like the drummer, right? Or he's like somehow in a pre-RKL band too.
Yeah, I mean, he was a few years older than me, so I never knew him. I never crossed paths with him like in those days. But everybody, every slightly older like Cito Rat guy in that scene would claim him as one of their own. And I never believed it until a couple of years ago when I heard him on, I feel like it was the interview he did on the Marc Maron podcast where he talks about that. And I was like, oh my God, that was real. He was friends with all those guys. You know, who knew?
Well, and then there's also like, I can't believe I'm blanking on his name, but the singer of Dr. No, right? Was like another child star.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, I didn't know him back in those days. From Courtship of Eddie's Father. Yeah. Yeah.
It feels like, well, it just like, I don't know, there's a lot of, from the Hernandez brothers, there's a lot of cool history in Nardcore.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, you know, like Nardcore was a little further to the south from where we were, but you know, like the Mystic Records thing, I think ties that all together. But like, you know, like Santa Barbara was, you know, especially in those days, like when, you know, I was a kid, I didn't have access to be, you know, tooling around like that far out of my, you know, I just knew my little area.
Did you know Brian Walsby back in the day, who played drums in Scared Straight? He did a lot of art too for bands, did flyers, did the Nardcore comp art.
I don't think so.
He was actually asked to be the drummer in Nirvana before Dave was.
Oh, wow.
He moved out to, he was friends with the Melvins guys and he hit him up.
Oh, wow.
First, and he wasn't a Bleach fan. And then so I think it would have been a different trajectory though with him playing drums.
Could have been.
Very different world.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
So you mentioned getting back into it, or like there feels like there's a scene kind of coalescing. Like, how did you kind of begin kind of hanging? Well, I guess you're friends with all these people the whole way through.
Yeah, sort of. Like, you know, I moved to LA and it was real clear that there was the whole kind of rock world was not really, there just wasn't much to it anymore, and just music was changing and all that like alt rock stuff was bubbling up and the punk rock world was getting bigger and bigger, and I played around in bands in LA for a little while. And then moved up to San Francisco in 1995. And it was just real good timing. I got a job at Fat Records and worked there just really for a few weeks. And then Ed left No Use for a Name and they needed a guitar player. And it was like one of those situations where they had a tour that they were leaving for, you know, this was like Tuesday and they had to leave on Monday or I forget, you know, something like that. And they needed somebody to step in there and do it. So I'm pretty sure I'm the only person that auditioned for the gig. And Mike basically put, you know, just said, oh, you guys should have this guy do it. And and they did. And then it was just off to the races.
Like, you had also written a song that's on Trash, right? The Lagwagon record. Like, were you playing with them or is that just, how did that happen?
No, I didn't. I just played a guitar solo on one of those songs. I didn't write anything on that record, but I played a guitar solo. And then there's that song with me and my friend. There's that song Stoking the Neighbors that Joey wrote about a wild night with my friend Dave. Hanasek, and so we do like the party narration in the middle of it to try to reenact some actual events that took place. But no, Joey was like, he was just a very good friend. I was friends with all those guys, but and I'm actually on the album cover. I'm supposed to be the goalie of the Lagwagon soccer team. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Okay. That's there's also a, cause you also wrote So Sorry too for 22 Jacks around then, or is that like a couple years after?
That was a little while later. Yeah. That would have been like, that was already in No Use for a Name. I don't remember when that record, it would have been, I don't know. We probably wrote that in like 96 or something. I don't remember when that first 22 Jacks record came out, but yeah.
I think it's 96. Maybe a killer song though. I love that song. That's an awesome one.
Yeah, that was a fun one. That was an interesting thing because I was in No Use for a Name at that point. Joe was a very close friend, and we wrote that song together. And then he went and made the record, so I didn't actually play on that record. It's funny how this stuff works out. Like, I didn't play on that record, but I'm in the band photo on it. and then did it and toured a bunch for it. And then I think played a little bit on, I think he put out a compilation record of like some stuff. And cause I recorded a bit with them, but then we made Making Friends and then went on tour again, you know, with you. So yeah.
It's talk about a cool lineup of that band too. 22 Jacks. So you go through Steve Soto, obviously, and Joe Sib. Like, there's like a real interesting lineage through everyone's bands and that thing.
Oh yeah, I mean, like I met Steve Soto through Joe. Like, I think the week that I met Joe, which was years and years before all that, he took me to go see Joyride and Manic Hispanic down in Orange County. I think that's the first time I ever met Soto, but yeah, Soto was such a legend, just such a sweetheart of a dude, you know?
Yeah.
He was always so much fun. He was, you know, we would just pick his brain about adolescent stuff and Orange County punk rock stuff. And, you know, he was awesome. Love that guy.
Yeah. Rest in peace. Cause such a cool dude. And yeah. How wild was that show though? Like that Manic Hispanic show in Orange County. I always hear their shows were particularly hairy.
It was in a park. I remember that. It was in the daytime and it was in a park. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it was good. Yeah.
In terms of No Use for a Name, like when you joined the band, it feels like they were blowing up. Like there was a moment.
It was an interesting thing because I got hired at Fat Records. My job at Fat Records was, you know, you got to remember this is like the beginning of 95. That's the punk rock explosion is in full swing. The Green Day, Offspring, you know, on the radio selling gazillions of records. And then everybody was kind of caught up in their slipstream a little bit. And so that song Soulmate from Leche Con Carne, the No Use for Name record, was getting a little radio airplay. And my job at Fat Records was to call record stores and make sure they had the No Use for a Name record in stock. And I was calling like mom and pop record stores that had SoundScan. I remember because like the SoundScan part of that was important because if it SoundScan better, then it would get more spins on the radio. You know, it was all kind of tied into that. But really like the whole reason I had a job at Fat Records was because of the No Use for a Name record, right? And then I wound up getting to join their band and going out and going on tour. The very first tour that we did was a really strange one because it was sort of half radio festivals, which is a thing that, as you know, you go do to try to, you know, shake some hands and kiss some babies and get some more radio airplay or whatever. And so it was all these radio festivals, and then it was half that and then half just kind of regular punk rock shows, you know, like at the Elks Lodge or whatever with a shitty PA and a old piano on stage, you know. It was this weird, and I remember getting the itinerary for it and looking at it and just being like, oh my God, looking at the venues that we were playing, it would be like, you know, 25,000 capacity. Like, what? We're going to be playing to 25,000 people, but having no idea that for us, we're on at noon you know, to nobody, to just like a sea of empty plastic seats, you know? But it was, I remember there would be like the radio festivals would either be, it'd be like the, a lot of them were like that, where it was weird. And you'd be like, wait, we're playing Duran Duran? Huh? You know? But yeah, we'd be on, you know, in real early in the day. But then sometimes you'd be like on the parking lot stage. And I remember the parking lot stage was always great. Parking lot stage would be packed and it'd be feel like a, you know, big crazy show. And sometimes it'd be a club show, but with another band that was out doing the radio festival, you know, promo hustle. And those shows would be really good too. But it, when you got that like noon, you know, inside the shed with just a sea of nobody, those were, would be a little disheartening.
Oh, we've definitely, we because of the name Fucked Up, we don't get offered a lot of radio shows, but we've definitely played some festivals in that early morning on a Sunday noon slot where everyone's still asleep. And it's like, wow, weird. But like, I think that time period, you guys are playing those festivals. There's a lot of people that are doing those interesting, or a lot of interesting bands, I should say, on that radio circuit. Like, or they're trying, right? Like Foo Fighters would have been playing that. I know the Jawbreaker guys said they were playing with the Foo Fighters around then. It feels
Well, I saw that tour. I saw two shows on that tour, actually, that when they toured with Foos. It was Jawbreaker, Ween, and Foo Fighters. Those are the first two Foo Fighters shows I ever went to. And I saw it at the Warfield in San Francisco, and then I saw it at the County Bowl down in Santa Barbara a couple days later.
What a weird package. That's awesome.
I know, it's great. Those are great shows.
Yeah, that is unbelievable. I think that's wicked. Ween did have punk connections too. They started as a punk band way back when too. So I guess it's like all of them once again come out of that punk rock lineage.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually just interviewed Blake for my Shred Rashady podcast. Which it's not out yet, but it's coming out soon. Or it might be out by the time you post this. But it was really cool to talk to him and get his perspective on that time period for them. Because, you know, that was such a strange time. There was so much weird baggage in alt-rock and punk rock about, you know, who could do what. And you signed to a major label, you're bad guys, you know, all that stuff, you know. And just strange times.
Well, it's so fascinating to kind of look back on then when there was – you know, like real stakes kind of put on this stuff. Like Jello Biafra famously got his legs broken by someone accusing him of being a sellout. The Gilman, like there's people were fight on site, angry about this stuff. And now here we are and we're all part of the Matrix now. Like we're all on Spotify. We're all on like Max talking to each other on telecom companies. Like it's.
Well, I mean, and even at the time, I mean, it was such a funny thing, like you know, all the punk rock labels, indie labels, they all went through distributors. Like nobody ever thought about that side of it, that were like, you know, yeah, there were some indie distributors and stuff, but a lot of them were going through the same distributors as major labels. It's like amounted to the same thing. It's like a total nonsense argument that people would have. Like I remember when I was in No Use for a Name, and like I said, but I said this before, but like Mike really did run his label with like I don't want to, but like he was very good to his bands, mm-hmm. you know, very, very good to his bands in a way that, he was very loyal, you know, very, very supportive and very supportive financially, you know? But because I think Fat Records had blown up, you know, and was big and was sort of viewed by certain parts of the punk rock world as like a sellout label or something. I remember a kid at a No Use for a Name show ringing me up about like, what's it like to be on a sellout label or corporate label? I was like, dude, what are you fucking talking about? Like, you don't like 99.999% of the people that were all so wound up about, they just didn't know anything. They weren't in it. They didn't know anything about what they were talking. I said, dude, look at you. Like, who made that watch on your arm? Who made that G-Shock? Who made those jeans? Like, what the fuck are you talking? Corporate? What? Like, look at what you support. Like, I mean, wake up, dummy. You're arguing. You're like missing. Like, put that energy into something that matters, you know, because this doesn't.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like a religion, right? Like we are all like worshiping the same four-letter God, but at the same time, it's like such slight different versions of this thing, especially back then. Like, well, I think now it's slightly different.
To me, it always felt like some kind of upper middle class obsession for people to just, you know, in the way that a lot of pretend progressive politics are now today, in a way to sort of smoke screen, to not deal with like real shit. You know, there are real class issues that people, you know, I would want people to have at the forefront of their thinking, and they don't, because they get obsessed with like completely insignificant little details on things that just don't fucking matter in the long run, when there's much, much, much bigger fish to fry.
Do you think being on Fat Records at a certain point was almost like a detriment to Noise for a Name? Like, do you think you guys would have been better served trying to jump to a major label?
No, because I don't think we were a band that would have succeeded in that realm. Knowing what I know now about how major labels work, I mean, you know, it's like, unless you're going to write big hit, you know, anthems and stuff, and not even just musically. I mean, who knows? You know, any band can sort of evolve musically or whatever, but like the work that goes into, you know, getting to those higher levels of the music industry, it's like, I don't think people we couldn't, you know, I don't want to talk shit about Noise for a Name because I love being a No Use for a Name, but like, if you go back and look at like our actual sort of work rate, we weren't working that hard, man. We would go on tour every 6 months or something, you know what I mean? It wasn't like, you know, bam, 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 bam. It's just like, and then the reality is if you even want to have a shot at like making it, it's your whole fucking life, and it's your whole fucking life till the end of time, you know?
Because it felt like Noise for a Name was on tour quite a bit, but I guess it's also the type of touring you're doing is like, it's kind of like a grueling type of touring at that point still. Like,
I mean, honestly, we just didn't tour that much. And, you know, at least in the years that I was in the band, I can't really speak to what happened before or after, but it's just that is the reality of that, you know.
What was that first Warped Tour like? Because you did the first Warped Tour, right?
It was really fun, but it was really fucked up. It was a complete mess, but I made a lot of really great lifelong friends, and it felt like you were sort of unified in this wacky adventure that was sort of not quite working, you know.
Yeah.
in a lot of places.
Well, it's interesting to like look back on that tour and playing huge venues, but there's not really like a headliner in the way that you'd expect.
And there also wasn't really a crowd in those huge venues. We played to a lot of empty parking lots on that run. I will tell you, the next year that we were not on, in 96, like, I couldn't believe how much that tour jumped up and just seemed to almost like from 96 on become this much bigger thing. And you know, obviously it became a really important, you know, like an important festival tour for a lot of bands, you know. It was like really broke out of the Warped Tour.
It felt like by the next year also, 96, Pennywise and NoFX had kind of leveled up to the point where they could kind of be like a tentpole act on something like that. Deftones too, sure. Right? I guess started the next year.
Yeah. Well, on that first one, I mean, you have for some of it, No Doubt was on there sort of before before they really took off. Deftones were on there a little bit, way before they took off. And then, like, you know, the headliners were like Quicksand and L7, I guess, and a bunch of other
Sublime
bands.
Right?
Sublime was on there in that sort of period that was between that first radio hit. It was a kind of well before that, and then it was obviously before before the really big record. But yeah, I mean, really, really fun. But you were like drinking lukewarm Hefeweizen in a, you know, 107 degree heat in Texas in a parking lot. Somebody was like, you know, eating promoter pasta. That was, I quickly learned I would go to catering and I would like get my meal, but then I would also load up a plate for later and go and stick that, you know, in my bunk and come back late, you know, late at night drunk after, you know, drinking a bunch of warm Hefeweizen and eat hose water promoter pasta before I passed out.
That's probably why the Foo Fighters have the best catering probably I've ever experienced anywhere, is because all of you are used to like squat pasta and promoter pasta.
Yeah, never again.
Never again. Never again. Yeah. Well, it's great to get a break from it as an opening act, let me tell you. Because it is but it's interesting also, like the Velvet Underground's first record, everyone that bought that record went out and started a band. But I think everyone that was in those half empty parking lots wound up being sort of the next, like that was almost like the start of whatever the thing that came after grunge was.
Yeah. Oh, it's really interesting. Like I've for many years, like I meet people, it's just in places in the sort of industry and beyond that you just wouldn't expect. I just hear it all the time. People come up to me and go like, dude, I saw you in No Use for a Name in 1996 at a VFW all in Cleveland or what, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it'd be like, you know, some dude that's like a DJ or, you know, and just a completely different, you know, part of the music industry. I think that, yeah, there was, it's interesting, like not only that part of it, but just so many people from that first tour I've just continued to run into and be friends with, and, you know, just still in it. It's great.
Yeah. I saw you in a parking lot in Toronto at the CNE, with, No Use for a Name at that first Warped Tour.
That was
my
really?
First show. That was my first show.
I remember that show. And it was the reason I remember that show is because my strap broke.
Yeah. I, you know what? I remember there being something weird. I remember there being a lot of weird things going on at that show, but I do. The CNE was like my favorite, like that's like, you know, where our state fair type thing is up here. Right. So going there, there was a food pavilion that had free samples. So my friend and I just went, not knowing that you had to wear sunscreen. Got incredible sunburns in this massive parking lot and ate free food samples all day. And basically it was the foundation of the rest of my life. That's like, you know, living in that moment still this day.
Right. Yeah.
It is a key foot stop in, but it's so fascinating too, because like at this time, I guess this is where, when you meet the 10 Foot Pole guys, cause you wind up doing solos on their next record, right? Unleashed.
Yeah. When did I really meet them? We went on tour with them.
The NoFX? Is like NoFX, No Use for a Name tour? 10 Foot Pole tour?
I don't even remember. I remember we toured with them several times. And we were good friends with them. Steve Carnan was a very close friend in those. He even came on a 22 Jacks tour one time, I remember. Steve Carnan from 10 Foot Pole built the inner loft of the 22 Jacks van, because we had built a really shoddy version of that and tried to go out on tour, and he was like he's like a great carpenter or something, and he just looked at it and was like, that ain't gonna last. And so on the first day off, we went to the hardware store and he tuned that thing right up, did it for real.
Oh, that's awesome.
They were good friends, man. We toured with them a lot. Yeah.
And then you wind up doing the solos on Unleashed. They put you down as like hot guitar player or like shit hot guitar licks or something, I think.
Yeah, that was a little bit later, but yeah, that I've got to go back and find that.
It's, I guess, like interesting time too at that point, because like there's a lot of like, you know, like, is this band going to be the next Green Day? I guess it's like pre Blink-182, post Nirvana, everything, but there's like a lot of like, you know, major label, I guess, attention, or at least, I don't know, was there actually major label attention? It seems like from the outside, there was a lot of like write-ups in magazines and stuff like this around this time.
Well, it's funny. This goes back to that thing, like, you know, at the time, I just did not really know anything about how sort of the music industry works. So we didn't have a manager through most of that time. Large periods of time there early on, we didn't have a booking agent. So when that was all kind of going on, I mean, I remember one major label approaching us a bit, and just kind of feeling it out. But I don't think we ever even really seriously entertained signing to a different label. If that was so good to No Use for a Name. I mean, they were like really good to us. Like, you know, it wouldn't have made sense to try to do the major label thing. And I don't think most of the bands, as evidenced by the fact that most of the bands that did sign a major label, like, it just kind of didn't work, you know? Yeah, like
a lot did though, right? Like Bracket, Hagfish, and
yeah, I mean, lots of bands did sign a major label. There's nothing against it. I just, you know, that's you're really rolling the dice, you know. There's only, you know, out of that whole scene, I mean, who had really massive success that really drove that? It's like Green Day and The Offspring, and that's pretty much it, you know. And then a little bit later, Blink, you know. Mm-hmm.
And Offspring had it on the indie, you know. It's like, that's one of those weird moments where it feels like obviously there are a lot of people working that record, and not to undercut their work, but at the same time, it feels like that's like a real lottery kind of moment.
Sure. Sure. And I remember even back then, like Fat Mike talking about like, what's the right way to put this? Like, it wasn't like, I just think he knew that, like, with his own band, it just wasn't like major label music. It's not mainstream music. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you could maybe get a big advance or whatever, but like for the long term, it's going to make more sense to, if you really want to do this for a long time, to not go that route, because that's just, you know, the mainstream music industry only cares about one thing. It's hits. If you're not writing hits, it ain't gonna work, you know?
But I think with The Offspring, it's almost like those, like, there's just so many things about that that's like, that's not a hit on paper, you know, to like pitch that and be like, yeah, this band is going to be the band that's going to sell 10 million records off this.
Well, yeah, I mean, and with any sort of new thing, there's no track record of anybody having success with it. And then somebody comes along and blows up, and then a bunch of people, you know, come in and copy that sound. So, yeah, it's like, you know, in the same way that you would have never thought when, I'm sure Nirvana never thought when they were recording Nevermind that where that was going to go. And I'm sure Guns N' Roses didn't think when they were recording Appetite where that was going to go, and so forth and so on. But like, somebody's got to kick these scenes off, you know what I mean?
I think with like, there's intangibles with Nirvana and Green Day that I don't see aesthetically in The Offspring in the same way, right? Like the blue eyes or Billy Joe's puppy dog looks, like, I just don't think The Offspring have, you know, I don't mean to run them down. They're perfectly handsome people, but like, it just on paper, it just feels like to me, that's maybe that's my personal obsession, but it just feels like a real outside chance that would be the one that would do it.
Well, especially also doing it on an indie, like you said, like, yeah, that's the super, I mean, that's, there's, you know, every now and again in the music industry, there's these anomalies that occur, but you can't really bank on it.
Well, and like you said, also, it's like, there's the other side of it is like, there's the hard work, right? Like The Offspring were, what, three records deep by that point? Like, they had toured, they had done the squat, they had eaten that promote, like, probably worse than promote a pasta, squat pasta type thing too, right? So.
Oh, yeah. And then, I mean, and that's just the beginning. I mean, then once you, I mean, I can only imagine what that would have been like the, when those records took off, I mean, those bands, the workload would have gone up at 10 million percent, you know?
It feels like that also breaks up a lot of bands, or like crushes a lot of bands too. And it's not even, you know, not making it. It's even like the success of trying to survive and weather that.
Sure. Yeah. Cause go, 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 you know?
Yeah. It's a lot of
work.
You
have to have a certain constitution, you know, I think to want to live that life.
Yeah. I feel like there was a moment where, you know, I feel like I tasted it and what that would be like. And I just don't think I had the constitution for it. Like, not that we had the songs for it either, but I just don't think I had the, you know, for what it takes to kind of the Warped Tour style touring.
Oh yeah. Well, Warped Tour in particular, where you're never in a hotel and all that sort of stuff. That's a particularly grueling type of touring, you know, but just all of it, you know, like, I mean, being away from your family, being away from your friends, I'm not going to complain about it. It's the life I love and the life I always wanted to have. But it does come with its own, you know, whatever hardships and challenges or what, you know, but yeah.
Well, it's fascinating when you talk to like comedians or pro wrestlers, like a lot of these sort of like similar sort of like vagabond kind of like existences where it is this thing that's amazing, but it's also sort of this like gilded cage cursed blessing at the same time. Like you're saying, you're away all the time and you're living life between your jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, I think like we've been particularly lucky, like, you know, with like being able to bring our kids out and really like, you know, for me, a big part of why I ever wanted to be a musician in the first place, because I never went anywhere, I think, you know, looking back, because we never traveled. The whole world was a mystery, you know? And I love that my wife and I have been able to bring our kids kind of all over the place, and they've gotten to grow up being far more worldly than I ever was as a kid. You know, it's great. That's certainly, it's stuff like that. That's those are like the upsides to it, you know?
Yeah. I'm not bringing my kids on the damn tour I'm leaving for in 2 hours. I tell you that much. So unfortunately they're not going to be around to see the Damned on this thing, but
wait, are you guys going out with the Damned?
Yeah, we're doing a week with the Damned right now.
Yeah.
Like in 2 hours.
Are they still doing the original lineup version?
I heard Rat Scabies is out, and I heard Brian James, it might be not playing with him these days. It's Captain Sensible and Dave Vanian.
Oh, right on.
We've also just been told protocols is we're not allowed guests backstage because they're very worried about getting ill.
COVID is like totally rearing its head in the touring world. We've had a lot of folks on our crew go down recently again. I was like, oh fuck, here we go again.
It's the reality of being in a band, is that we're constantly exposed to it, right? Like every day is a new airport or a new truck stop or a new backstage, right? Where
yeah, and I mean, just it did you trip out like on when touring started to come back on, like, I was super freaked out about selfies, you know, like
getting
hot pitted by strangers. I was like, oh no, I'm going to get sick every day, you know.
First night of tour, we walk out on stage and I had all these plans because I had seen Tony Adolescent play with two masks on, right? Like he does three masks when Tony Adolescent sings.
Really?
Now he's got like a three mask thing that he does it with. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it with a mask. So first song in, the mask goes into my mouth. I take the mask off and this guy jumps on stage to sing along with me. And I'm like, well, it's over. This is it.
Yeah.
And I just kind of surrendered myself to the process at that point. And of course, we end up getting COVID by the end of that tour, but it was
it's
the new reality.
It's tough. When a big part of your job is interacting with lots and lots of people, it's hard to keep that shit out.
It's weird because there's like a lot of things that it's just like hard to try and like keep out when you're in a band, you know, like the mental anguish, the physical anguish. Like it feels like a lot of it is like fortifying yourself against the world a little bit, and against your own band at times too, with my I'm still with the same group of people, so
fortifying yourself against your own band.
You gotta put up those walls.
Been there, bro. I know what you mean. Yeah.
when you joined the Foo Fighters, did it feel like being in the other, because Robert Trujillo was on the podcast and we talked about how when he joined Metallica, I kind of was like, you know, you've been in this band with Mike Muir, you'd been in this band with Ozzy Osbourne, like you were prepared for all these different type of personality types. So when you can go into the situation and adapt to it, like, do you think like these situations have prepared you to be in this band where you can kind of go into this band and adapt to all these different people and kind of feel it out right away?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, I think being in No Use in particular prepared me for it, because like it was a very similar situation where I joined a band quickly and didn't know anybody else in the band or on the crew or anything, and just had to jump into it. And a big part of being in a band is being able to get along in tight spaces, in the van itself or backstage or hotel rooms or whatever. And so, yeah, you know, it's all those years leading up to, like, if I had never done that and just jumped into being in the Foo Fighters, like, I don't, you know, I mean, I would have been so stoked anyway that I probably would have just been like, yippee, you know, whatever. but like, yeah, I don't know if my van skills would have been as tuned up as they were, you know?
Yeah. I find like that's a lot of band, and ultimately that's what keeps bands together over the long term is ego management. It doesn't matter how good your band is. If you can't figure a way to handle each other, it's going to fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I've been in those situations, you know, when I first joined No Use for a Name, you know, for the first year or so, there was a lot of tension between our singer and our bass player. And that just kind of bled over into a lot of stuff and made for some very kind of uncomfortable long drives and whatnot. And ultimately led to the bass player leaving, you know, and that's hard to be in that room when that's going on, you know?
I love thinking about the Foo Fighters and trying to figure out what shows you would have all been in the room for at different times in your previous bands, and like being like, oh yeah, they might have been together, they might have played at this show together, or they might have ran into each other.
Well, I mean, I definitely know that, you know, I remember it very clearly when Rat Pack opened up for Scream at this Chinese restaurant down on State Street in Santa Barbara, and when Dave was playing drums, and that was a very memorable gig, you know.
Wow, that's a new one for me. I was going to try and connect you through Pat Smear being at some sort of Twisted Root show or Tater Tot show at some point, but man, I had no idea about the Rat Pack Scream connection.
Yeah, and the funny thing, and we were just talking about this the other night because we played up in Santa Barbara, and Dave was talking about this on stage, but they actually went and stayed at our drummer's house, which I didn't even know at the time had happened. And I'd like kick myself like, wait, why didn't I go back to Sean's house and party with Scream, man? That would have been a way cooler end of that story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even then, and that would have been in whenever that was, 88, 87, somewhere around there. Like I remember Dave playing drums at that show. And I remember in particular because our drummer took some ecstasy and was basically like, almost like on top of Dave during their set. Like he was high out of his mind and just like so excited, you know? Yeah. Oddly enough, that's the one show from back then that no photographs seem to exist from. Like there's no, I have never seen a photo of that show.
Is there a flyer? Because there's a, you know, there's that Scream website that has like almost every flyer for every Scream show that ever happened.
You would think that there, I mean, there most certainly would have been, although I don't recall ever seeing one. And it was a Chinese restaurant down on State Street that only, to my memory, ever had a couple of shows. And it was just kind of for a brief moment there. And I remember the other show that they had was RKL, of course. But yeah, that was... Yeah, there's no evidence that it ever happened, but it did, I swear. I shouldn't have been a responsible young man that night. I should have not worried about getting up for school the next morning, and I should have gone to Sean Murphy's house.
So this is pre you dropping out of school for Rat Pack.
Yeah, but it was most certainly one of the nights that led to it. Yeah.
Chris, this has been awesome. And anytime you want to come back on this podcast and talk about punk or hardcore or... glam or whatever.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me. It's funny that it took this long for us to pull this off, but I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you. I miss you.
Thank you, Chris, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Chris will be back for a part two at some point in the future. In the meantime, check out Lost at Sea. See Chris on tour this new year in Auckland or in Europe somewhere. And or check out the Foo Fighters. They're a good band. They're going to go places, I think. And that's it for this episode. Coming up on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk, we got a real wild, interesting one for you. Not only is this person a former member of the FUs, the Straw Dogs, Agnostic Front, and others, but they also played on the first vinyl appearance of Slick Rick the Ruler, and started Nasty Little Man PR, which you may know from the Beastie Boys record, Hello Nasty. I guess it's immortalized by the Beastie Boys record, Hello Nasty. Steve Martin is on the show this week. Not to be confused with the comedian Steve Martin, but Steve Martin, the music industry legend, the hardcore legend, and we got a lot to talk about. This is a fun one, and that is on the next one. And that's it for this week. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. Stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths, different races, different nationalities, because we're not talking about politics. This is just basic human rights shit. People deserve to be able to live free from hatred, from violence, from discrimination. And if there's groups in your community that are affecting positive change and you want to get involved, get involved. Volunteer your time, volunteer your money. If you can spare it, I'm sure they could use it. You can also try meditating. I didn't believe in it myself, and now I find it very beneficial. A lot of people have been saying this for centuries. Maybe try it. And if it doesn't work at first, try it a couple times. Go out there and make your own culture, because anyone can do this shit. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a record label, put on shows, because punk gets better when you contribute to it. Definitely. And last but not least, sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. You're actually making less work for the person that has to deal with your body. Oh, that's morbid. But just sign your organ donor cards, because I've seen it perform miracles. And maybe it'll perform a miracle when you do it. Oh my gosh, this is getting so heavy. Thank you for listening. This is the first episode of the new year, so I guess this celebration of the new year. So if you celebrate this version of the new year, happy new year. And if you don't, I'll wish you happy new year on your new year's too. But thank you everyone for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode. Bye.